Hey, hey, and welcome to Stopping By. I'm Doug Pierce, Senior Vice President and Financial Advisor with Pinnacle Wealth Partners at UBS Financial.
And I'm Jess DeBeer, Associate Director and Senior Wealth Strategy Associate, also with Pinnacle Wealth Partners. We are located in Mount Laurel, New Jersey, and can be reached at pwp@ubs.com.
Our team's mission are Just Cause. It's bring financial literacy and competency to the masses. We've been fortunate to meet interesting people along the way. They have compelling life stories about overcoming adversity and seeking their passions. Hopefully, you'll see that our guests are just like you. So Jess, who's stopping by today?
Doug, today we are chatting with Admiral Jonathan Greenert, former Chief of U.S. Naval Operations and a current member of UBS's America's Advisory Council.
Four-star admiral.
I mean,
we are elevating this podcast. All right, let's meet who's stopping by today.
We went from sportsy sports to military.
I'll tell you what, we are some rugged people. We really are. We're bringing rough and tumble to the world of financial services.
Do you remember the first time you saw Top Gun? Were you out of diapers? Because I remember when I saw it.
I had to watch it in rerun. All right. It was already on like TNT, but I'm pretty sure TNT. Someone had to like cover my eyes when that first came on.
Well, I remember I was 12 in Vermont, in Middlebury, Vermont, with my best friend who had a summer house there. And we went to the local theater to see Top Gun, and I was so like blown away by it. I thought it was the coolest thing I'd ever seen in my entire life. I just was like, and you know, the volleyball scene, and I'm like young in hormones, and I had my favorite pilot. It was not Tom Cruise, because you know how I feel about Tom Cruise. Yeah. And sorry, Tom, if you're listening to this.
Let me guess, though, the volleyball scene, your favorite one was Iceman Wingman.
That's right.
Slider. Yeah? Slider.
Yeah. He was so cute. He's so tall. Tom Cruise.
No.
I'm just saying, like, out of all of those volleyball players, out of all of those pilots, no. I want to ask the Admiral, did you ever have because I'm just going to keep bringing it back to Top Gun. Did you ever have a Top Gun-ish moment where you're in the sub or you're on the carrier where there was an active engagement that you had to address, like a threat to national security, and you were in charge? And what was it? Give us the play-by-play.
I think you ask him, what was your favorite? Which movie did you like better? Top Gun or Hunt for the Red October?
Ooh, I'm going to ask him.
Good. All right, very good. All right, so let's start with our intro here. Today, ladies and gentlemen, we are honored to welcome a truly distinguished guest, Admiral Jonathan Greenert. Admiral Greenert served as the 30th Chief of Naval Operations, the highest ranking officer in the U.S. Navy, and a member of the Joint Chiefs of Staff. Over his career spanning four decades, he commanded at every level, from submarines to fleets, and helped shape U.S. naval strategy during some of the most complex and rapidly evolving periods in modern defense history. He's known not only for his leadership in military operations, but also for his deep commitment to innovation, global security, and strategic foresight, especially in the maritime domain. Since retiring from active duty, Admiral Greenert has continued to serve the public through policy work, advising on national security issues, and helping the next generation of leaders think about the challenges ahead. In 2016, Admiral Greenert joined UBS's America's Advisory Council as advisor to us and our clients on geopolitical risk. His advice has been critical, especially in light of the Russian invasion of Ukraine. The Admiral brings a wealth of experience, a global perspective, and a reputation for integrity and thoughtfulness. We are thrilled to have him on today's episode. Admiral Greenert, thanks for stopping by.
Thank you. The honor is all mine. And so is the pleasure.
Thank you for being here, Admiral. We are not worthy. We are just so happy to have you here today, and we do like to start with a good origin story. Before I do that, my first burning question is, I have to know, Top Gun or The Hunt for Red October?
I like The Hunt for Red October, and there's two reasons for that. Top Gun is, frankly, it's used up, for lack of a better term. The aircraft stories have evolved to, they don't operate exactly like that today. The Hunt for Red October is alive and well. You know, there are Red Octobers out there as we speak. They're being hunted.
Yeah. Yikes. Really? Wait, really?
Yeah.
And, okay.
And honestly, you know, you're going to go to your biography and mine is nuclear submarine. So
that's true. That's true. So let's dig into it. Tell us, we love a good origin story. You grew up in Butler, Pennsylvania. And so tell us what first sparked your interest in the Navy and what prompted you to choose the Naval Academy?
Yeah, that's a nice question. And a lot of people presume that somebody who reaches the higher ranks of the military had some sort of predetermined journey. Yeah. Nothing near that. I grew up in Butler, Pennsylvania, as you said. I grew up in a blue-collar town. I'm one of six children at that time, and my two older sisters went to nursing school. Dad sat me down about ninth grade and said, son, I'm out of money set aside for any kind of education for you, and your grades have got to change, or you're going to go work at the mill. And I said, oh, that's all I need to know. So I was looking for a scholarship somewhere. Where is there a scholarship? My dad's brother lived in Annapolis. I knew there was a school there. I did some research and I found out if you go to school at the Naval Academy, you get a scholarship. You pay it back by serving in the Navy. So I applied to the Naval Academy at West Point. I got into West Point. I didn't get in at first the Naval Academy, but eventually did near the end of the screening process. And off I go to the Naval Academy for the purposes of a scholarship, really.
So it was purely, hey, kid, we're out of cash. You got to figure it out. And you were like, well, this is one of the ways. And so because of that, you avoided being drafted, obviously.
Yeah.
Wow.
To me, it was like, if I can avoid this, I'll go this route.
Yeah.
It seems to knock out two birds with one stone, you know, get the education, avoid going to Vietnam and getting drafted, and then you serve it off when you're done. You're dead free.
Oh my gosh. Okay. So you served aboard submarines like the USS Flying Fish and commanded the USS Honolulu. First of all, is there a height? I'm a tall lady. Okay. I live with gigantic people. Is there a height max in a sub?
Yeah. It's about, think of it as about 75 inches, about like 6'3".
Oh.
So you're ducking that. And everybody has to duck when you go in between compartments. Submarines have either four or five compartments.
Yeah. Well, so, Doug, I know you were dying to know that height question. So that
was
for you.
I was sitting there, I was like, we're good. Like, that my people, we're good over here. We excel on airplanes, subs. Yeah.
My son, he's not going to be able to be in a sub.
All right. Well, so let's talk nuclear, because I've heard you talk about this. It's fascinating to me that, you know, we have this thing that's powered, like nuclear, especially today, is getting a lot more attention. And the fact that we've had this thing powered underwater, tell us about the history of how we got nuclear in submarines.
So not long after the end of World War II, we realized, not till the end of the war, how valuable a submarine could be for not only in case of war, but for deterrence.
Hmm.
In other words, if you can hide and your adversary knows you can hide and they can't find you, then they don't want to mess with you, for lack of a better term.
Mm-hmm.
And they know you could kind of be everywhere. And so that causes them great anxiety and gives you great deterrence. All right. So it was determined by a guy by the name of Hyman Rickover. He was an engineering duty officer. He was an engineer, knew very much about submarine systems and power systems. Up until that point, and today for non-nuclear, submarines operate on a battery. You need a lot of power. But unfortunately, mm-hmm. we didn't have battery technology, which would give you a lot of power for a lot of time. So they had to be recharged. Now, when you're going to charge them, you have to come up either on the surface or close to the surface, bring air into a diesel engine, run the diesel engine, and the generator running from the diesel engine will charge the battery. So that made you vulnerable.
Sure.
So Admiral Rickover said, you know, I think we should put a nuclear reactor in a submarine, because a nuclear reactor generates heat through fission, and that fission generates heat. You run the heat, the water under high pressure, very hot, that ran through the reactor, with that water will heat through a pipe in a heat exchanger. It'll boil water, and you send the steam from boiling that water through a turbine generator.
Now, I just jump in and ask a quick question. So I think explosion, nuclear bomb. Right.
Yeah.
And so for a guy to propose, this would have been what?
Early 60s.
60s. So he's proposing we take this thing that we've seen explode, the mushroom cloud kind of thing, and we put it into a tin can And we stick our best and our brightest down there underwater in the stick cam right next to this potentially explosive device.
And
right?
They're like,
great idea.
That's Jack. A very good question, Doug. That, the fact is, before we did what is known as the Manhattan Project with Oppenheimer and all those people, we were looking at the concept of fission and nuclear to generate heat, controlled heat, and to do what I'm describing, to use it to, you know, the heat source is a virtually unlimited heat source. You control it slowly and use it, you know, for good. So, Doug, the first idea was to do what Rickover said. Well, let's get back to this. The war is over. Mm-hmm. We were talking about this. And he wanted to harness all of this knowledge that these folks had generated in the concept of a small nuclear reactor and put it in a submarine. And if you think about it, he went from idea to the submarine operating in under 10 years.
Now, that's insane.
Yeah, it is. And today's concept of doing anything close to that,
insane,
it makes my head explode.
This is going to sound like a dumb question. I'm just going to ask it. The U.S. was the first to come up with this, with nuclear subs. Are we the only country that has them? No.
No, we did at the time and for a long time. We had the lead in nuclear submarines. We still do.
Yeah.
Our technology is, say, 5, 6, 7, 8 years that we are ahead of others, and we have to continue to do that.
Yeah.
The context for that would be, today we put the first reactor in a nuclear submarine. It goes for 30 years. You don't have to refuel it. So you're good for
at least. Wow.
Yeah.
Oh,
aircraft carrier, 50 years.
What?
No fuel. You don't have to refuel. 50 years. Think of that.
What is the longest time you've spent submerged?
About 75 days.
Days.
Yeah.
What? Hold on. Excuse me. Pause, please. 75 days submerged with only men?
Yeah.
At that time, only men. Did it smell? I just have to know.
No, actually, because the value of this is, well, first of all, you have a nuclear reactor, so you make a lot of heat. It's unlimited.
Yeah.
So you have a lot of hot water. There's no reason not to take showers.
Okay. All right. Good.
Is the chain of command or like the sort of the interaction between the servicemen on a sub different in that environment because the stakes are so high as it is anywhere else in the military?
Yeah, I would say yes, with a few caveats. Number one, nobody's on this first name basis. You're not all buddies. So there's definitely a hierarchy of supervision, of command, if you will, and responsibility. Captain's ultimately responsible for everything that happens on board. There's an understanding of, if you will, respect for everybody because they're all qualified to do what we were talking about. Number two, you have to inculcate in all of them that I respect you very much, but you have to do your job because all our lives depend on you. There ain't no slackers here. And if you don't like it, get off. You know, we're all in this together. It's a very unproportional situation. If we flood, we're all dying. Mm-hmm. And if we have a fire, gets out of control, we're all dying.
Right.
We're not losing some of us.
Oh, man.
There's an element of camaraderie.
Yeah.
I don't want to use the term cheat death, but I think you know what I mean. Pilots that take off and land on a carrier, they have this swagger. I kind of understand that. If you watch an aircraft get launched off a carrier, you go from 0 to 150 miles an hour, boom, you're gone. And then you bring this thing in and a carrier looks so big until you're up, you know, at 12,000 feet coming down. You say, where is it? So the feeling to be able to do that in the rain, at night, crosswind. So you move to nuclear submarine. We're taking this 300-foot long cylinder down underwater. This is inherently stupid to do, right? And you're taking steel and salt water. That's dumb too. You know, and you're going looking for other submarines to get close to record what they, you know, how they work and what they do. That's dumb. So that's a lot of dumbness all lined up. It's kind of risky business in its own right, but it's a risk you need to understand and manage.
I want to talk about your tenure as commander for the U.S. 7th Fleet in the Asia Pacific from 2004 to 2006. Can you tell us what stands out as a defining challenge during that time or achievement?
It was, frankly, the best job I ever had. And he said, wait a minute, you were the head of the Navy. I said, I know. He's still the head of government. The extent of control is the whole Asia Pacific. So it's from the international dateline to India. So all the naval operations in there are yours. So I'll give you an example of two things that happened. In 2004, there was a big tsunami, earthquake and tsunami. We were in the Indian Ocean. We had an enormous tsunami, and it wiped out a lot of people in Thailand. And Indonesia, a lot of damage in Indonesia, and some in Sri Lanka and India. There's this humanitarian disaster out there.
Yeah.
Now, this happened not long after Operation Iraqi Freedom. Indonesia is a Muslim country, almost 100%. Next door to it is Malaysia, and they're probably in the 70 percentile. Mm-hmm. They didn't want anything to do with us at that point because we invaded a Muslim country, and the narrative within the Muslim community was, hey, this is West versus Muslim. And this is now in the Pacific, and the entire focus of the country, the Department of Defense, is in the Middle East at this point.
It's right after 9/11, yeah.
And there's a tremendous humanitarian disaster. Dead people, wiped out, no power. So we sent an aircraft carrier that was in Hong Kong on a visit down to anchor off the ports in Indonesia, and we offered power and water and whatever else we could do. So logistics ashore. And they said, no thanks. And we said, well, give us a chance here. We won't come ashore. Bring people out, whatever. And we found a center point, and we provided recovery aid. So we were using it by ships, and it was small. We were bringing helicopters in to drop that off. Too slow. It's not working. We needed to get to an airfield. The head of the Pacific Command at that time went to school with the head of the military for Indonesia. He called him up, and he said, do you remember me? And he said, yeah. They didn't say, no way, he's a Christian. I'm a Muslim. I can't talk to him. He knew him personally. And they negotiated a few things. Number one, nobody wears camouflage stuff, so you look military. You're going to look like you're invading us. Number two, no guns. Well, that's kind of hard. So what do we do about security? I said, we'll provide security. So now you have to entrust security to a Muslim nation. And so I go on and on about this. We overcame all of these thresholds and barriers. And so we started flooding airplanes in. And then we brought a couple of very, very large container ships just full of like diapers, water, food, generators. And then we brought two hospital ships. So we went from, they didn't want to see us, talk to us or anything, to saying, you know, these guys are all right. Next thing you know, we were able to get port visits. And it was a movement toward an eventual restoration and actually better relations with this fully Muslim nation in the middle of the Pacific. And by the way, a nation of like 200 million. That's not nothing. So that happened during my tenure. And it was remarkable to watch it. I was the fleet commander overseeing the generation of courses moving in there, et cetera, et cetera. We learned a lot of stuff about what do you do if you've got volcanic eruptions, tsunamis. Everybody got smart on tsunamis the hard way. It was, some call it soft power. Some call it, you know, do the international relations piece. It's an anecdote of what I'm telling you is, you know, we're out there saying, all right, we got to be ready to fight China. We got airplanes, bombs, missiles. Yeah. And say, well, there's another side to this. They're not going to ever be our ally, but they sure are our friends now. Mm-hmm. And they sure understand us a lot better. And they sure are willing to, you know, see our side of things before where we were really out of it. If you have time, I'll give you one more.
Yes, please.
So this is kind of a sad tale, but it turned out right. So we have about 50,000 people live, U.S. people live in Japan. About 35,000 of them live in Yokosuka. Yokosuka is a very industrial area in Japan outside of Tokyo. So that's where we are, and our Navy ships are there. We don't have a port because it's not our territory, but we share a port with the Japanese Navy. So our sailors go ashore and embed themselves, you know, visiting restaurants, going to Tokyo. And well, we had this situation where a sailor got very drunk, kind of out of control, and he mugged a woman and killed her.
Oh my gosh.
Yeah. This happened in the city of Yokosuka. We were on the cusp at this time of negotiating, you know, kind of the next phase of our time in the city. That time.
Oh, my God.
There, like everywhere, there's activists. They say, you know, we shouldn't have these people in our country anymore. This gave tremendous voice to that. What is the lesson that I learned in all that goes about? What are we going to do now? Fortunately, got with the mayor and got with a few others and said, how do I possibly apologize on behalf of the U.S. Navy, on behalf of the crew of that aircraft carrier that guy was from, and on behalf of the country, because I'm the senior U.S. guy in the city,
the guy.
Embassy and all that. And the ambassador said, hey, over to you.
You know? Right. He punt. They want to punt. They don't want that.
Yeah, it's all you. I don't mean that pejoratively, but, you know, so what am I going to do? You know, I could go to the prime minister, but this isn't at the prime minister level. But the problem is these things can generate and steamroll. And, you know, you can get an avalanche of bad publicity. And we're about to make a decision to bring a nuclear aircraft carrier to Japan. We never had a nuclear aircraft carrier in Japan. This is 2006. We had one picked. It was going to be the Ronald Reagan. They said, we like Ronald Reagan. And it's the story of working with the mayor, local chamber of commerce, particular business people that have great influence, influencers, for lack of a better term, mm-hmm. to apologize, seek restitution, find out how do we pay back this family. And in fact, there is a monetary value for loss of life, for accidents, for deliberateness, and for, you know what I mean, mm-hmm. that your family can pay. I'm not saying you're forgiven, but they don't seek further litigation on you, which is, as you know, very important. I don't think you can do that in this country. Mm-hmm. You know, you're never not out of danger of being sued for whatever.
Yeah.
But there, it's different. Fortunately, really due to the good graces of local leaders, Japanese leaders, influencers, yeah. and that saw the bigger picture and stayed with us. We have a nuclear aircraft carrier in Japan. And thank goodness we do, because this was before China really emerged. This is 2006. Mm. You know, China was just about on their breakout, for lack of a better term.
So in kind of researching you, one of the things, I always ask ChatGPT to throw out things. And I was saying, you know, give me the top five chief of naval. You were listed as an honorable mention among the top because of you innovated naval warfare through shipboard lasers, electromagnetic railguns, and unmanned. I mean, you brought that to our military. So let's talk about that. Which of these was your favorite kind of lasting innovation?
I think electromagnetic warfare, I should say, for defense of a ship. China and Russia are building what is now hypersonic, we call it. We didn't have that term there, but very fast and highly maneuverable cruise missiles. It'd be hard to hit them with a bullet. Bullets, whatever you want. You can get a rapid fire gun and he's put up like a wall of lead. Well, that's a temporary measure. Mm. And that'll knock down maybe two if they're coming at the same time. Now what? On the other hand, if you can use electromagnetic radiation to jam or spoof their seeker that they're using to track you, they may be using a link or a laser that is on you. And if you can jam a laser or whatever, then it can't find you and it'll go in the water or go do other things. You know, in my mind, I said, look, we can't afford to shoot stuff down. We need to figure out how to jam this stuff or confuse it, or make it much more difficult to find out where we are. Back in the Soviet Union days, we used to have this thing called emission control. You turn everything off. You turn the radars off, no more communicating. And we used that to drive up into the North Atlantic and go into the fjords of Norway and stuff and see if we could sneak close to the Soviet Union. They were using satellites and land radars to listen for our communications. But if you're not communicating, okay, they're not getting a signal. I like that because we can do that now. So we had to get back to the basics on that kind of stuff. It's more applicable to all the vessels that we have, if you could spoof or jam. And it's easier to spoof or jam than it is to use a radar to track you. Lasers are a huge return on investment if we can get that. And we're very, very close to putting lasers on lots of ships. But there's quite a legal element to this. I said, I'm going to put a laser gun on a auxiliary ship, not a destroyer yet. I'm going to go out in the Arabian Gulf and do two things. I'm going to see how it operates in the heat, in the dust, and it's very humid out there. There's rumor that lasers and rain, fog, and that get attenuated. They're not affected, which is baloney. It's not true. We found that out. This was before the Iran nuclear deal. This was before that. And Iran was behaving, well, like they are now. They were harassing our ships going through the Strait of Hormuz in and out of the Gulf. And we were very concerned that they would use a swarm of small boats and maybe attack one of our ships. So I said, well, if we can demonstrate for them how a laser works, that is, you laze these small boats and or the drones that they were using and destroy them, that could be a good signal to them, a deterrent. I had to get permission to send this laser into the Gulf because the laser is forever. So let's say I've got the gun and I'm pointing it at something and I start chasing it and I miss whatever I'm shooting at.
Oh, my God.
The laser keeps going, so I hit a commercial something. That's not good, right?
Oh, yeah.
So there was a lot of leak. And if I pointed to the sky, there's satellites up there somewhere, probably, maybe. And that laser goes all the way. Now, is it that powerful by the time it gets there? No, of course not.
Yeah.
So there was a lot of legal aspect that we had to get clear, which was quite frustrating, but I understand that it's necessary.
Yeah.
And I only mentioned that to you. A lot of people say, what's taking us so long to get our autonomous laser, all this stuff is ready. Everybody else has it. Say, well, we're not like everybody else. China doesn't worry about what I just described. They don't care. Mm-hmm. We do. And we have international agreements that we comply with, and we have to figure our way through that. We are.
Yeah.
It's just that it takes too long for many people.
Let's talk about your time after. You know, you exit, 40 years of service. And we have to mention, you are a member of the UBS America's Advisory Council. So tell us about your role there and why were you drawn to, you're working in the military and then you're like, no, I'm going to work with a Swiss bank.
That's a little peculiar. You've heard this before. It's all about relations, network, who you meet. First of all, when you leave the military as a senior officer, a 4-star, a 3-star, you sort of have to decide, do I want to go to another organization and maybe be in senior management? Or do I want to maybe be more advising, consulting? I went the latter. You run into people and there's a lot of kind people helping people like me to say, what are you interested in? I'll connect you with a person. I met a guy and he introduced me to Bob McCann, who was president of UBS at the time.
Okay.
So we set aside 15 minutes and we go in. And he didn't know who I was. Well, I'm from Butler, which is just north of Pittsburgh, and his dad and he are from North Pittsburgh. So we're from not the same neighborhood, pretty close.
Yeah.
My dad's a steel worker. His dad was a cop. Both big Steelers fans. So we talked for well over an hour and he said, cool. And then he said, I've been thinking of putting together what is the President's Advisory Council. I became what Bob was looking for from the perspective of he wanted to take UBS and he wanted to ensure embedded in UBS an awareness of U.S. regulations, processes in the government, how things work, the geopolitical landscape, because he felt UBS being an international firm, rotated people, and the rules of international investing, banking, et cetera, are different from U.S.
Mm-hmm.
And he says that contributed to the problems UBS had in 2008-09, the banking issues and the mortgages and all that. Bob came in subsequent to all that, and he said, I need to set the foundation of principles, values, and how we're going to do business. So I could use me, for leadership, executive development, ethics, principles, and geopolitical. And the whole thing emerged. Bob retired, and I thought that was the end. And Tom Naratil kept me on, and I'm still on. I'd just say, the firm is, I think, a high-value firm of high ethics and standards, and I'm deeply impressed with the C-suite, if you will, and all the way down to the people I've run into who know how to do the right thing and do the right thing. And there's a real desire to do the right thing, not only on behalf of their clients, but in general, for the good of the firm.
Well, coming from you especially, that means a lot. It really does.
Thank you.
And it's great to have you as a resource too. Talking to financial advisors, it's very inspiring, but also talking to clients about these are some of the things that we're seeing. You're not a talking head on TV. You're like, no, I've commanded in the Pacific League. I've dealt with leaders. Like, that's a big deal.
Thank you.
One of the things you talked to us about too is your relationship with the schools in Pittsburgh.
Yes.
Tell us about that program and what you do for children.
Oh, yeah. Thank you. It's called the Extra Mile Foundation. So it's a foundation started by, well, the Rooneys.
Let me bring Jess up to speed. The owner of the Pittsburgh Steelers, legacy family.
Could you see? I was like, the Rooneys.
That's an iconic.
They have a legacy beyond football.
Okay, got it.
So the Rooney family, the Diocese of Pittsburgh, and some other folks have donated and brought together the Extra Mile Foundation, which is a foundation whose function is to support a series of Catholic schools. There are four of them, and they are grade schools, so K through 8, mm-hmm. and to provide scholarships for inner city kids to go to school there. Not only provides the education, but the meals, and includes breakfast. In many cases, it's providing clothing. The attendance is in the 90 percentile, 95%. Kids love going there. Mm-hmm. So the Extra Mile Foundation, I love it because, okay, K through 8, and then if a kid, eighth grade, and they say, I want to go to this high school, that high school, whatever, if it's private, they will give them a scholarship there. It's a remarkable thing socially. You say, okay, but what about reading, writing, and arithmetic? The last two sessions where they do standardized testing in the state of Pennsylvania, remember, these are underprivileged kids, the vast majority of them. Not one of them scored below the bottom norm, if you will. So they're norm or above. In math and reading, you know, I'll tell you an anecdote. I was talking to a potential investor here at UBS, and he wants to talk about Taiwan because he's thinking of investing in Taiwan Semiconductor Manufacturing Company, TSMC, who is the premier semiconductor manufacturer in the world. Still is. Mm-hmm. And a lot of people are concerned about that because of the China-Taiwan problem. So I talked to him about the situation. Because he's thinking, I'm not going to put any money in Taiwan if it's going to get invaded. I said, well, situation. Turned out he was very comfortable with the situation. He invests a lot of money. He asked me a question. He said, would you do any philanthropy? And he said, well, what's your favorite charity? So I told him the Extra Mile Foundation. I didn't know he was going to do this. Yeah. Right. So this lady, the director, calls me and said, do you know this guy? And I said, I don't remember that name. And she says, well, he sent this in on your behalf. And then it hit me.
Yeah.
You never know.
Admiral, with all due respect, I'm looking at the chart of TSMC, where I don't know when you talked to him about investing. He might owe you a bigger check.
Oh, my goodness. Well, Admiral, this has been such a delight. We do have some wrap-up signature questions that we ask all of our guests, and that is, can you share your earliest memory surrounding money? And secondly, what does money mean to you?
Yeah, my earliest memory surrounding money. No, I wanted freedom as a young teen. We were probably low middle class, six kids and all that. So, I was not without, but as far as spending money and freedom, so I got jobs. I sold a magazine called TV Guide. Nobody ever uses TV. 15 cents each. I had a paper route. Yeah, okay. I had a paper route. So that was good. Let me say at the age of 12, I had a paper route, and I'd say that's where I learned the concept of money. There's a need to, it has to be part of your life. It can be your life if you want, but it has to be at least part of it.
I love it.
So the concept of having some freedom and being able to, you know, meet some of your goals, as long as they're not crazy, that's fine. And then anything beyond that, it's like, well, you can take more risk or not.
Mm-hmm. Well said, sir. Well said. Yes. This has just been so delightful chatting with you. I have learned so much. I feel honored to be in your presence. It's just been delightful. And I hope you stay on at UBS for many, many years to come so we can see you more.
Thank you for being gracious with it. And thank you for stopping by.
Thanks for stopping by.
You're welcome. It's been my pleasure. Thank you both.
Bye-bye.
Take care.
Bye.
Wow. What an amazing dude.
Did I really ask him if submarines are smelly? Did I really ask the man in charge of the entire United States Navy if the subs are smelly? Did I do that? I did do that,
absolutely,
right?
Of course you did. I liked your opener too. Top Gun or The Hunt for the Red Eye. And sure enough, listen, some of that stuff's made up. This movie, that's for real.
Yeah,
I'm going to go back and watch that movie.
I know, me too.
What a
if
cool
not just
guy.
For Alec Baldwin, young Alec Baldwin. What
just
a
the
cool
thought
guy.
Of these subs going all over the place, surreptitiously surveilling, and we're looking for them, they're looking for us, and that's some real deal. That's happening all the time.
All the time.
And here, like when I'm on an airplane and I can't get Wi-Fi service, I'm like, what the heck's going on?
This podcast is presented for informational purposes only and should not be relied upon as investment advice or the basis for making any investment decisions. It does not constitute an offer to sell or a solicitation of an offer to buy any specific product or service. UBS does not provide legal or tax advice, and we would recommend listeners to obtain appropriate independent professional advice. Some of the views and opinions expressed may not be those of UBS Group AG or its affiliates. UBS Financial Services Inc. offers investment advisory services in its capacity as an SEC registered investment advisor and brokerage services in its capacity as an SEC registered broker dealer. These services are separate and distinct, differ in material ways, and are governed by different laws and separate arrangements. It is important that you understand the ways in which we conduct business and that you carefully read the agreements and disclosures that we provide about the products or services we offer. For more information, please review client relationship summary provided at ubs.com/relationship summary. UBS Financial Services, Inc. is a subsidiary of UBS Group AG and is a member of FINRA and SIPC.